Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. This is the Donald on a Kitchen. You have the great good fortune of joining us here at the KHOI studios. This is Community Radio, and we're having a good time here. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Donna is back from an adventure, and she's going to
tell us. Oh, boy, I had a great time.
And we're going to hear about it, too. This is Community Radio. It is put together by your goodwill. It is owned by the community. We're mostly all volunteers here. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused, since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Yes, we do. This is the Donald in the Kitchen. We get together and we talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions, and travel today.
Yeah, and we get a little political, not in the party and voting sense, but certainly in the environmental and agricultural sense. After all, we are in the heartland of the USA.
Yes, and politics does affect us even if we say we don't care, because...
Oh, but we do care.
We do care.
We do care. Maybe too much, but we do care.
Well, we've all decided to drive on the right side of the road here. That's political. We decided on something. And there's other things we have to decide on
as a
community.
We have national habits for the well-being of all.
So, more about that later. Oh, it's fall. This last weekend,
Yeah, we even had a brief moment of chilly weather.
Oh, it's fallish-ish. It's nice.
I know. I put a sweater on.
It's time. The Octagon Art Festival was held here on Main Street in Ames on Sunday. There were all sorts of good things happening there. The KHOI Radio, that's us, had a booth. Thank you to all who stopped by and said hi at that booth. We were out here in front of the studio on Douglas Avenue, and we had a good time because we were asking people to record station IDs for us, and with a little bit of giggling and false starts, we got a whole lot of people that supported us by doing that. So listen for new voices on this radio station. There's a lot of stuff at the Art Fest besides really nice art, especially a lot of nice sculpture this year. Those people that move in the heavy sculpture, it's really lovely. I love to watch us look at that sort of stuff. There's food trucks. Food trucks just popped up all over the place.
Oh, yes.
On
Everybody
Main Street.
Loves a food truck these days, me included.
Yeah. If you want to ask an opinion, we have something else to talk about here in Central Iowa besides the weather. Ask the opinion of your friends. So, who has the best quesadilla? Who has the best ribs?
Favorite food truck?
Yes. People have opinions about this sort of thing. And they're in great fine fettle. The Mobile Mallard was there.
This is a new addition to our food truck fleet locally.
It's large. It's green. It's the food truck from the Mucky Duck Pub south
of town.
And it's
carrying British food.
It is. And it's carrying Marcus, the owner, inside. So that was there. That's
He's
kind of a new
ever
addition.
A creative fellow, I must say.
He is. And another little bit about the Mucky Duck. They now have a dog-friendly patio. Huh? So check that out.
And Lana
out.
Has a friendly dog.
Well, yeah, we're going to check that out. And I had, every Thursday they have cask beer there. That means.
Oh, this sounds like lots of fun. I hope I remember to go on Thursday.
Mark your calendars, Thursdays. If you want beer that has not been pasteurized, I believe is the term, just beer that's kind of ready to go, just kind
the
of.
The real deal, fresh, homemade
stuff.
Kind
oh,
of.
Yeah.
Nobody knows how it's going to taste. It's
good.
A little bit of an adventure here on the palate.
It is good. But they had a cask that they opened up on Thursday. from the Confluence Brewing Company.
So this is an Iowa beer.
Yes, and they have to drink it up fast because it only lasts a day or two. It was a wonderful dark beer.
So Lana was there drinking. What did you think?
Well, in the interest of Donna Lana Kitchen research, I had some of this wonderful cask beer, and it was a dark beer with hints of chocolate and mint.
See, that sounds so interesting to
me. Yeah, give it a try. There's all kinds of good beer out there. And also in the interest of Donna Lana Kitchen research, at the Octagon Art Fest, I wanted to do this, I tried a Mac Attack.
She was very brave.
Well, I wanted to try this. This is macaroni and cheese, deep fried in tempura batter.
And you didn't even have to go to the state fair for this, Lana.
No, I didn't. It was right there, right here in central Iowa on a beautiful day with some aioli sauce with it. And what
fat on fat.
What I can say about that is it was filling. Yes, it was filling.
Yeah, well, you probably needed a green salad afterwards or something.
No, what I had after that was a root beer float. Huh? I was
celebrating.
She was
really
summer.
Trying to do some damage to herself here.
And that was from Sweet Treats. Sweet Treats from Jewel, Iowa. There's an ice cream company out in Jewel, Iowa. And it's a little farmette, a little place right outside of town. And they have a truck, too.
Oh, wow.
So Sweet Treats in Jewel, Iowa. And you can get good homemade ice cream up there. Ha. So Donna, tell us about your adventure. Where were you?
I was invited by a lovely friend of mine, an old friend of mine, to go to Costa Rica to his biodynamic farm, which is also an eco-resort. And while I was there, it also was the board meeting for Greenpeace. Tom, my friend, is on the board. So we were in a great setting, a very interesting group of people, and wonderful, wonderful food. And I did a very long recording about some issues that Tom is very passionate about, and I totally concur with him. I'm just going to start by saying last night was the first presidential debate, and there was a moment where the candidates were talking about the most pressing issue of our time.
Underline.
Yes, it was major. It was maybe the clearest point-blank discussion in the whole thing. You know, it really wasn't just policy wonking around there. But that issue was declared, particularly by one candidate, to be, nuclear disarmament. And, of course, that's a pressing issue. But I have to say, that has been a pressing issue my whole life, and I am not a spring chicken here. You know, I was a teenager when the Cuban Missile Crisis started. This is an ongoing issue, and I personally feel that the most pressing issue of our time
underline
is climate change, because that's a certainty. I'm sorry, I have to disagree with some small minority in the country who isn't listening to the science. And of course, a lot of the there's two problems with talking about climate change. One is it tends to be put into the future. Well, I'm sorry, it is really in the present, as anybody who noticed from the incredible flooding that we had a few days ago. It's not some distant future catastrophe. It's happening now and needs to be dealt with now, for sure. And then the other thing is everybody seems to think if we just simply stop burning fossil fuels, it's going to go away. Yeah, this is true. Leave it in the ground is very, very important. And stopping fossil fuel burning and having electrical cars and solar panels and, of course, our lovely Iowa wind turbines, all these things are terribly, terribly important. However, even if we stop using all the fossil fuels, we still have already put way too much carbon into the atmosphere. And this carbon that we've disbalanced our precious atmosphere with is going to go on wreaking havoc for at least 100 years, which is way past my lifetime and probably past my children's lifetime. So the wonderful thing about my friend Tom Newmark is he is working very seriously on carbon sequestration. Now, that's a very simple, yes, it's scientific, but it's not high tech. It's not like, oh, we all have to go to the moon or Mars or Elon Musk or those kinds of scenarios. It is simply that the carbon that is in the air doing so much damage should be going back into the ground, where it's very a positive effect.
And that has been that is the cycle that has been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, and will continue to do that for a long time. And, of course, through agricultural processes over the last 100 to 150 years, we have unbalanced our carbon cycle on the planet. And so Tom talks a lot about, and we're going to play a very long interview that was so long that we're putting it in today's show and in next week's show. So we kind of start with the bummer news, and then we go on to Tom talking a lot about carbon sequestration, which is very important for farmers and all of us. So, Lana and I felt that this topic is important enough that we are going to drag you through this interview for two consecutive shows, and I hope that it's heartening to you. So let's hear. This is from Costa Rica, where I recorded. You will hear the various... I have to say, there were no mosquito bites. You know why? It's not that there's not mosquitoes in the rainforest. It's that their ecosystem is so imbalanced. They still have enough birds and bats and frogs that they eat the mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes pretty much leave the people alone. It's amazing. So, from mosquito-infested Iowa, we will now go to Costa Rica. Okay, so here we are in the middle of Costa Rica, at the lovely Finca Nueva Luna. Say it for me, Tom.
Finca Luna Nueva Lodge.
And I am with Tom Newmark, who is the proprietor of this farm. It's a farm. It's a biodynamic farm.
Yes, a biodynamic regenerative farm.
And Tom is also the founder of something called the Carbon Underground. So he is really... very thoughtful in his agricultural understanding. And it is a pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's a joy to have you here, Donna. Thank you for coming all the way down to visit with us.
Oh, and we've been eating very well. Very, very well.
Farm to table here at Finca Luna Nueva.
Yeah, they have their own dairy. Of course, millions of fruits that I've never heard of.
You even recently had a sour pickle fruit off of a sour pickle-like tray.
What was that called?
Bilimbi.
Bilimbi. So it's a thing that looks like a pickle, and when you bite into it, it tastes like a lime. So we made a sugar syrup with the bilimbi and mixed it with rum and fruit juice for cocktails. Ha ha ha. So tell me about the farming and let's talk about the regenerative part. Let's do the serious policy wonk stuff first.
We are in the midst of an existential threat to the survival of humanity on the planet. This is a very sober and thought-through comment. We know that we are in the midst of climate change. We know that the oceans are rising. We know that global temperatures are increasing. We know that there is an avalanche of species extinction and a collapse of biodiversity. We know that at a certain point, we will reach that dread tipping point where life as we know it on the planet will no longer be feasible.
And this is our bummer news, as I often report.
We're going to start with a nightmarish vision of unending disaster, and we're going to end on a note of tremendous hope with the spring in our step.
Absolutely. That is the most thrilling part of being here. Of course, Tom will tell you that even though the fossil fuel industry is a huge component of global warming, there is an even bigger contributor to climate change.
Enterprises.
Tom, what's that international statistic of smallholder farms? What's the percentage of farmers in the world are smallholders?
70% of the food for humans is produced by smallholder farmers, and that means farmers that are farming less than 2 hectares or about 5 acres.
So that sort of shoots big holes in the Iowa motto, "We are feeding the world."
Well, the old Earl Butts, Secretary of Agriculture, Nixon-era statement, go big or go home, is not accurate. There are 2 billion smallholder farmers, the majority of them being women, that are feeding their families, their communities, their villages, their towns. They produce 70% of the world's food using only 30% of the agricultural resources, which means, very simply and beyond cavil, that smallholder farming is far more efficient
Absolutely.
In the production of food, calories, and energy and nutrition than factory industrial farming. And here's what else we know for a fact. We know that from the time of the Industrial Revolution to today, there have been, let's just use 1850 as that marker. There have been several hundred billion tons of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere.
And it wasn't all from combustion engines.
The majority of the excess CO2, which now poisons us and threatens our existence, came from the soil, came from
tilling the soil.
What I would call agricultural malpractice.
Starting with the Dust Bowl is a great example that all Americans remember and understand.
So it is the breaking apart of the soil through deep, repeated, continuous plowing, heavy tilling, exposing the organic matter in the soil to decomposition forces of decomposition bacteria, sunlight, and oxygen. The erosion of that heavily tilled soil that has lost its structure or its tilt. The carbon matter in the soil that had been stable in a sequestered form for hundreds of thousands and even millions of years has, as a result of heavy, repeated tilling and the application of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, the forces of industrial agriculture have released from the Industrial Revolution to date more CO2 in the atmosphere than the burning of all fossil fuels worldwide. And even now, according to an NGO called GRAIN, G-R-A-I-N.
Right, based in England.
A respected international organization. The overall food production and food delivery system. Agriculture is responsible for between 47 and 53% of all current man-made sources of greenhouse gases. So whether
Say that one more time. It's got to sink in.
Okay.
57...
Between 47 and 53%
is caused by agricultural practices.
By agricultural practices. Now, that includes, just to be clear, the fossil fuels used in the production of the delivery of food.
Mm-hmm.
It includes
mm-hmm.
the wasting of food and the methane from landfills from food. But the current food production and delivery system, modern agriculture, the modern system of eating,
mm-hmm.
that is responsible for approximately half of all current greenhouse gases, and historically more than half have come from what I would call the malpractice, the violence against the soil brought about by industrial, extractive, monoculture, chemical-based agriculture.
We're not talking about the small farm holders here.
We're not, although because of the pervasive influence of the so-called and inaptly named Green Revolution, because of the reach of the Green Revolution into India and elsewhere, many smallholder farmers have been convinced, have been tricked into destroying their soil, their family's legacy, by using both tilling and chemicals. And
This is KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
And we are listening to an interview that I recorded last week in Costa Rica with Tom Newbark, who is one of the co-founders of Carbon Underground and Regeneration International. We're talking about carbon sequestration.
And so it's important for us now to reverse the damage of the chemical. So the White House issued a report about a month ago.
Oh, this is fairly recent for the White House.
This is the United States government issued a report saying that by the end of this century, the United States will no longer have sufficient topsoil to produce any food.
More. Okay, okay.
So the White House says by the end of this century, we'll no longer have topsoil for food. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization about a year ago issued a report saying that as a planet, we only have enough topsoil left for 60 more harvests.
60 more harvests. Well, and we have a lot of that topsoil sitting in Iowa.
It used to be. A lot of it is
now it's down the Mississippi, but
and in the atmosphere. It's either oxidized or eroded.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have a scientist that is a friend of mine, Steve Applebaum, said that there are areas of the Great Plains that used to have 100 feet of topsoil. And that was the great gift. For all of us who are patriotic Americans, where this land is our land. It must be a horrifying realization that our agricultural malpractice has squandered the legacy that our forefathers have given us.
I would say malpractice. Tom's a lawyer by training, so I just want you to know the use of the word malpractice is not taken lightly.
No, it is either negligent or reckless, and perhaps sometimes even intentional destruction, knowing destruction of the topsoil. We have known, so Iowa is neighbors the great farm state of Illinois, and in Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois has had a more than 100-year farming system trial at what are called the Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W plots, where we have now been able to look at the effect of farming practices for over 100 years.
Of conventional farming practices.
Of conventional farming, but there was a shift because from 1875 until 1925 or so, and the dates are slightly approximate, but the gist is correct. At the Morrow plots at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, for the first 40 or 50 years of that trial, there was no use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer.
That's when my father was there, and he thinks it was all a hoot. It was wonderful.
Yeah, but the period of time where they did not use synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, every year there was more soil organic matter than the year before.
So it's basically pre-World War II, kind of.
It was in between World Wars I and II where the shift occurred. And the moment that the university began to apply synthetic nitrogen fertilizer to the Morrow plots, from that moment on, every year, there has been a diminution of soil organic matter, a loss of carbon in the soil, a loss of topsoil. Whenever you produce food and in that production are losing a significant basis of soil fertility, that is definitionally unsustainable.
And this is by adding nitrogen, which is supposed to increase fertility, right?
And ironically, the same test site at the University of Illinois has studied nitrogen levels in the soil, and even after the consistent chronic use of synthetic nitrogen additives to the soil, every year the nitrogen levels in the soil diminishes.
Well, the math isn't adding up here, Tom. What's going on?
The practice doesn't work. What happens is that when you apply synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, it's like injecting a steroid promoting rapid, almost cancerous growth of organisms. I'm not sure that it's just certain. I think the entire soil food web is speeded up, and decomposition organisms are ramped up. And when the decomposition organisms are injected with basically a growth hormone, mm-hmm. the synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and they need food, they begin to literally eat the body of the soil, the structure, the tilth of the soil. The growth that happens after the application of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer is an uncontrolled cancerous growth that consumes the soil.
So like huge crop yields and all of the things that the Green Revolution thinks is wonderful. And
sure, huge crop yields when there was topsoil and when there was rain. But if you look at the Rodale test sites,
this is the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania.
When you look in the Lehigh Valley at their test sites,
this is in Pennsylvania,
for more than 30 years mm-hmm. in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, in the Lehigh Valley, looking at...
Oh, right. They have some of the longest-running trials of non-synthetic agriculture going on.
Well, they have regenerative organic agriculture compared to conventional agriculture. Same starting soil, same sunlight, same farmers.
About 30 years of
30-plus years.
Accrued research.
Starting by the famous thought leader and organic activist, Robert Rodale. And their research has shown that over that 30-plus year period, organic yields are the same as conventional, except during drought years. And during drought years, the organic yields are anywhere between 30 to 50% greater. And I've been to those sites. My mm-hmm. daughter Sarah and I, about 7 years ago, went to the Rodale farming system trial mm-hmm. during a drought year, and the conventional chemical corn was stunted and withered and unproductive, and the organic corn was taller than were we and yielding copious quantities of corn. And the difference is that organic soil has more carbon.
Because it's not been treated
with chemicals. And
right,
it's not
no nitrogen applications.
And therefore, it has a better water-holding capacity. For every percent of soil organic matter in the soil, that soil per acre can hold between 25 and 60,000 additional gallons of water. Conventional farming disintegrates, deteriorates
the holding capacity.
The soil water battery is what it's called.
Soil water battery. I like that image.
And regenerative organic agriculture regenerates, reconstructs the soil water battery. So, as a consequence, worldwide, you had the FAO say, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization of Nations.
Right.
You have the U.S. White House, the executive branch, saying we basically have 80 years left of soil. You have the British House of Commons, the environmental audit report for the British House of Commons this year said that in the United Kingdom, there is only one generation left of profitable, productive agriculture. That areas that used to have meters deep, rich topsoil, it's now bedrock. That's the bad news.
It's very,
and
very
this
bad.
This is whether you believe in climate change
right.
or
this
not.
Right, this is just about
We're
soil.
We're looking at whether there is soil and moisture in that soil necessary to produce food. And we now know from scientists worldwide that within either a generation or two, the world will be facing cataclysmic tipping point food system breakdowns.
Which also even with climate change, gives us no resiliency. Now, I want to ask, I know Tom's going to give us some good news in a few minutes, but first I want to put it in an Iowa perspective, because we have a lot of friends who are farmers, conventional, organic. You know, Iowa is full of wonderful, lovely family farms, some of whom are really onto this and doing a better, you know, I mean, building some topsoil and dealing with these issues. But it's a struggle there to get the information. Why doesn't everybody know this? How did we arrive at so much misinformation that even people, I mean, because farm owners don't want to destroy their land base.
Of course they don't.
Of course. So how are they, how is this happening? It makes no sense.
Well, we just learned that in the 1960s, the sugar lobby paid off Harvard in order to paint fats as the culprit for cardiovascular health.
Right, so that people would keep eating lots of sugar and start buying high sugar, no fat, things like snack wells and stuff like that.
And we know that for decades the tobacco lobby was painting the story that cigarettes were good for throat health and that the smartest doctors recommended.
And we know that the oil companies have known for decades that climate change was happening.
Yeah, so I'm not suggesting that, I guess I am suggesting that there has been deliberate misinformation. And I think that I would say to the farmers of Iowa and around the world that are looking to have fertility, profitability, and to leave a legacy of a healthy, productive farm to children and grandchildren, that you should look to your information sources, and that there are wonderful thought leaders at the NRCS within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There are brilliant agronomists within our government who are talking, but they're talking every day about the importance of regenerative agriculture to rebuild soil organic matter. The monopoly of thought that for decades has led to the systematic destruction of topsoil in the world, that is breaking down. And there are now important thought leaders within our government and within academia that are now courageously articulating a new vision of regenerative agriculture. Let me tell the farmers a story. I had dinner about 8 years ago with the CEO of a major organic company in California.
Farming company.
Mm-hmm. It was the CEO of Cal Organics.
Oh, big vegetable grower.
Major,
absolutely.
One of the largest organic producers in the world. Right, and he looked very elegant and well-tailored suit, and he looked very not at all a Birkenstock
farm.
So I said to him, "So why'd you go organic? Why are you an organic producer?" And he said, "Well, I have no philosophical attraction to organics. I just do it because I make more money.
Price premium."
Well, it's not just that. I said, You care to elaborate? He said, for sure. I have lower input costs and higher yields. And I said,
a winning formula,
And I said, you have higher yields? He said, absolutely. When my neighbor's fields are scorched and brown, mine are green and productive. They think I'm stealing their water. But what I'm doing is I'm farming in a way where the water is effectively used because I have organic matter. So this is not a philosophical hippie farmer, you know, with the long beard and brother sun sister moon sort of person. This is a businessman saying, I am farming in a way to build organic matter in my soil because my input costs are lower, my yields are higher, and I make more money.
In the end, his land is better.
Exactly. I have a friend down in the Delta region of Mississippi who bought land that had been so degraded by more than a century of chemical cotton farming
okay.
And overgrazing.
Cotton's even worse than corn, actually, probably.
Not even hunting lodges could use the land because it was dead. And when he bought this land 5 years ago, the soil organic content of the soil was under 0.5%. And this is in the rich delta of
right,
the Mississippi.
With plenty of rain.
With 40-plus inches of rain a year. And nothing was being produced there. And his neighbors are all still grazing in a conventional way.
Cattle.
So he bought this land, and he introduced what he calls adaptive multi-paddock grazing. This is Dr. Alan Williams. He taught at Louisiana State University.
So is this kind of like rotational grazing?
No, rotational grazing, I don't want to use that term. I would
okay.
say that its closest analog would be Alan Savory's holistic pasture management.
Oh, okay.
But and while there are similarities, they are quick to differentiate. But this is grazing that is an art farm form that respects the cycles of life in a very careful way.
And it really requires that the farmer, it's not a formula. The farmer has to look and see what's going on
right.
to make the decision of when to move the animals.
And as a consequence, his farm, the stocking capacity, the stocking rates of live cattle on his land after 4 or 5 years.
In Mississippi.
It's now 3 times greater than his neighbors. So his input costs are the same, and he has 3 times the livestock output of his neighbors. His soil organic matter has gone from 0.5 to almost 5% in 5 years. So his profits are higher. His land is being regenerated. He has regenerated the land so much that the people that sold him the land 5 years ago, a hunting lodge, because it was dead and not even wildlife were going there, want to buy it back at a profit because now all the wildlife has returned to his land.
And this has been replicated. For example, Will Harris in Georgia has done the same thing.
A genius.
And Will is the president of the American Grass-Fed Association and has... Tell us about Will. I love Will. He is a real, his family's been on that land for over 100 years.
Well, not only has he brought back the soil and the productivity of his land, but he's brought back his entire community.
Yeah, and Will is having a good time.
It's one of the most thrilling stories of a rural community that had been destroyed by the declining fortunes of the farmers and ranchers
of agriculture,
in the community.
Yes, and now, for sure.
And now there's a renaissance, a revival, a regeneration, not only of his profitability, of his productivity, of the organic matter in the soil, but of the wealth of the entire community.
Okay, and he did this by dramatically raising the number of animals per acre and the movement of them. Explain that, Tom.
He's using a system, and again, I there's a wonderful video produced by Peter Bick, B-Y-C-K, of an organization called Carbon Nation, which is affiliated with Arizona State University. And he has a series of videos.
So you could Google what?
I would Google Soil Carbon Cowboys.
Soil Carbon Cowboys. That sounds like a fun thing to Google anyway.
It is a 10 or 12 minute video. So look up Peter Bick's work.
B-Y-C-K.
Right. Peter, his work is compelling. He tells a story.
He's the filmmaker, right?
He's the filmmaker.
Okay.
And there you'll see an example of how using adaptive multi-paddock grazing. It's also referred to as AMP, A-M-P grazing. It's an analog of that.
Is this an Alan Savory?
An analog of that
okay.
is the Alan Savory Holistic Pasture Management. Now, those organizations believe that there's daylight between their practices, and I honor and respect. I salute both of those groups. But the key here is that back in the day before Europeans conquered North America, there were 50 to 75 million bison on the Great Plains. There were endless endless hundreds of millions of prairie dogs. There were pronghorn. There were ruminants beyond any imagination compared to what we have now in our factory farming model. But yet we were accreting organic matter in the soil.
It was
we
growing building. Topsoil.
When we took over this continent from our predecessors, there were meters and meters of rich topsoil in the Great Plains. But the grasslands of North America co-evolved with the grazers.
The bison, right.
That you have to have the chewing and the hoof impact.
And
the
manure defecation.
And
that's
the urine.
Right.
You have to have the chaos introduced, and where the land has plenty of time to recover.
Well, because it's like,
it's like humans.
Right. You drop enough manure and then you move on because you don't want to eat where you're pooping, right?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. And in fact.
And animals know that.
Well, animals may not know that exactly, but.
They do, Tom.
In the case of bison.
Yeah.
The stinging, biting flies that
rest in the cow pies.
Exactly. They arise after 3 days.
So it's a little alarm signal. Time to move, boys and girls.
One of my buddies is Dave Carter, he's the head of the American Bison Association.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
He told me the story of how it wasn't so much that bison knew to move on from chewing and hoofing and fertilizing their area of pasture that they were grazing. They were forced to move on by either the pressure of wolves or the pressure of stinging, biting flies that hatched after 3 days.
What an ecosystem.
Exactly. Nature had evolved a system that created an impact, which was critical. The animals would come in, create the impact, stir up the soil, fertilize it, chew the grasses down so where the grass's growth plate would be exposed to sunlight, and then moved on for a necessary recovery period. When you allow cattle to graze in the same place for a year in open, continuous grazing, they will eat only the finest foods that they like the best. They will eat them down to a stubble. They will destroy
those finest foods. It's like eating dessert all the time. Yeah.
Right? And what happens is the inferior food sources with lower Brix or sugar levels,
mm-hmm.
lower protein levels,
lower nutrients,
those
yeah.
will proliferate and the good foods will be eliminated and the soil will begin to deteriorate. So what we have to do using either the savory holistic livestock management system or the system articulated brilliantly by people like Dr. Alan Williams and Dr. Richard Teague at Texas A&M published a paper recently showing that those ranchers in Texas using adaptive multi-paddock grazing had a carrying capacity, a stocking rate, that was at least two times their neighbors, and soil organic matter was being regenerated at a rate of 3 tons per hectare per year.
Inches?
Inches. Can be.
Yeah.
Gabe Brown, a regenerative farmer and rancher, he has added more than 10 inches of topsoil.
What period of time?
I think over the last 19 years.
Poof.
That's an extraordinary amount. When people say, topsoil, it takes, Gabe Brown has done, I think, 11 inches in 19 years. So, grazing, comparing adaptive multi-paddock ranchers to conventional ranchers. Greater productivity, greater soil formation, and in the case...
We're getting to the good news, folks. Here, this is the good stuff.
And where in Texas, in the counties where the rivers had disappeared, ponds and streams were what are called ephemeral. They were only there a little bit of the year. After a few years of adaptive multi-paddock grazing, the rivers and streams and ponds were year-round. So I just want to tell all the farmers and all the people that eat food in Iowa.
And love farmers, yeah.
And love farmers. and to the children of farmers wondering what will happen to their land because they can see it degrading. This happens quickly. Regeneration happens quickly. The key to all of this is the recognition that soil organic matter is created by plants.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1 Story City, Ames and surrounding areas. You are also listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We talk about food and farming here, and we're getting right down to the bedrock, to the dirt of the matter here, and discussing carbon sequestration and what's going on with our soil. We've pretty much been listening to a really fine interview that Donna did with a man named Tom Newmark in Costa Rica.
Yes, Tom is the co-founder of the Carbon Underground and Regeneration International, and he is just full of information, hopeful information that's going to help us repair some of the damage that we've done to our atmosphere, get climate control back into its safe zone so that our children and our grandchildren have a future. After so much bummer news about, you know, if you've been paying attention to the pipeline in Iowa and talk about fracking, and it's difficult. We are in difficult times, and so there are solutions, and they're not high tech, and they're very doable, and they can happen right here in Iowa by changing farming practices that take the carbon out of the air and put it back in the ground through green leafy structures. So we can do this, folks, and we need to do it. And this interview was so long, Tom and I got carried away, that we're going to have the second segment of it next week. So tune in for part two on the Donalana Kitchen of Tom Newmark and the Carbon Underground. And then, of course, it will all be archived. So if you do want to listen to it all at a go, it's possible.
Yes, if you want to listen to more of this, you can go to khoifm.org. And this show is streamed. It's streamed live, but you can also download and get it onto a device of some sort.
Like a podcasty thing.
Yeah, one of those thingies. Yes,
yeah.
You can do that. Or Donalana Kitchen shows are archived. You can go to the khoifm.org website, find the talk section, find the Donalana Kitchen, and go to our archive and kind of scroll through there. There may be something that needs a second listen.
These episodes are going to be called Carbon Underground 1 and Carbon Underground 2.
Yes, they are. And you can also find a recipe page there if you can't get enough of us.
Yes. And my recipe for the Costa Rica trip was rum, pineapple juice, mango juice, and we use something called bulimbi, but you could use lime. It's a pretty common Costa Rican kind of flavored cocktail, and I really loved it. The other thing I did, and I am replicating here, I went out and I bought some dark rum at our local liquor store, and I added some unprocessed, not cocoa powder, but it's a product that I bought to make a cocoa beverage out of. But anyway, I am fusing the rum with unsweetened chocolate. And we'll have the results of that later.
Oh, I like this research.
It's a sipper, I think.
It sounds
on the rocks. Perhaps.
That is a Costa Rican thing. They grow cacao down
and
there,
and they have rum.
And they have rum. Good.
And the coffee was good too, by the way.
Oh,
yes.
Coffee. You mentioned because of climate change, they're having to make some changes in how they grow coffee.
Yes, the coffee growers, because the weather and the temperatures are changing slightly, they are having to move to higher elevations. Coffee is a very sensitive crop. So, you know, in Costa Rica, like everywhere, we are having the effects of climate change.
So here we are in central Iowa, and yes, we do have to think globally.
Yeah, we're having our own when I got home, it was during, I'm telling you, the climate in Iowa when I got back home was exactly in Costa Rica. Rain, high humidity, and it was in the mid to upper 70s. It felt exactly the same as it did in the rainforest.
Ooh, there you go. There you go. So we will have more Tom Newmark to come in a future show.
Next week.
Next week.
Tuesday.
At noon. And repeated at 7 p.m. in the evening. There is a couple upcoming things.
We got a lot going on in our community here in
Central
Iowa.
Farmers markets are still up and running. Get out there and
pick. And we haven't. Yeah. I haven't even had a frost yet, thank goodness.
That's unusual.
Very unusual.
I just kind of. The basil is kind of biting the dust, but other than that, things are looking pretty good.
I don't know. I bought a beautiful bunch of basil last week from you.
Well, that was kind of the last of it. I mean, you have to say goodbye.
Well, I'm drying it'll last all winter.
Things are going to bed, which is nice, but it's still green and lovely out there. It's good. It's good. There is going to be a cider pressing event this Saturday, October 1st, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Mustard Seed Community Farm.
With a lovely old wooden cider press.
Yes.
None of this high-tech stuff.
No. In the past, they said at the Mustard Seed Farm that this lovely old cider press, people have asked to borrow the cider press, but it's kind of like taking the mountain to Mojave and go to the mountain instead because it's hard to move.
It's large and it's heavy and it's old.
So if you have apples, any kind, just bring in apples in containers and take home
apple cider.
Be sure
to bring the jug to put the juice in.
Yes, you can take apples out there and we'll have a good time.
Yes, and once you get it home, it will be your choice whether to drink it all fresh or to put some aside and let it harden.
Mustard Seed Community Farm is located 10 miles northwest of Ames. Call 515-460-1467 or go to the Mustard Seed Community Farm website. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Radio. You can find us here every noon. Also hear us again Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. Find our archives and recipes at khoifm.org and find out lots of other good locally produced and nationally produced stuff on this community radio station. Support this station, volunteer, and listen. We're Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. I'm Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had engineering by Evan Taylor, and a fine job of it he did. Eat good food and enjoy life.